From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Global warming is on the G8 agenda in Scotland. The Kyoto Protocol is still a no-go for President Bush. He prefers new technologies to tackle climate change. Critics charge there's no American leadership on the issue. But at the local level, individual cities across the country, maybe even your town, are taking a stand. And the results may surprise you. Tonight on Point, the new push for local solutions to global warming. But first, we begin tonight near Gleneagles, Scotland, where the leaders of the world's top industrialized nations arrive today for the G8 summit. Richard Wolff is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I caught up with him on a noisy press bus headed into Gleneagles and asked him to describe the scene surrounding the meeting.
Well, there's very tight security everywhere. They've fenced off this huge golf course, police everywhere, and they're even flying in the dignitaries and even the humble journalists into a very distant airport, well away from any trouble. There has been a lot of protests on the ground. Transport's been disrupted, but the security is really very, very tight.
Tony Blair stood up today with Bob Geldof and Bono, superstars who have called for big aid for Africa. Has the whole cultural effort that's been rolled out in the recent days had an impact? Does it look like Tony Blair is going to get what he wants out of this meeting?
Well, you know, I was talking to a couple of White House officials about this earlier today, and they admit it has had an impact. And it's had an impact because, of course, people like Bono and Geldof have been really working with Tony Blair to raise the consciousness and put this high up on the agenda. We would not, for instance, have seen President Bush promising to double aid to Africa over the next several years were it not for this sustained campaign, both through the music rock stars and through his political allies like Blair.
And what can you tell us, Richard, about the negotiations that continue? Often the communiques are written before the summit's even held. This time we're told that's not the case. Is the negotiation still going on, and over what?
I'm told it's actually done now, but this has been a bit of a nail-biter for these officials. They'd like to sign these things, get them done very early, but there have been last-minute discussions on a whole range of things, mostly about the text of the final communique. There was wrinkles about the future of Africa, but I think one of the biggest bones of contention was about climate change, what we used to call global warming, and especially whether the problem was urgent or long-term. So there was some pernickety discussions about the language there.
You're on a bus headed into Gleneagles. We can hear your colleagues there, but President Bush has been talking a lot on his way to the summit. He's acknowledged in a way that's rare for him that humans are contributing to global warming.
Well, he has mentioned that before, but this has got a new prominence and a new emphasis. It is, of course, the bare minimum of a statement in terms of the human involvement in global warming. And actually, his father came out with was happy to sign up to statements that were far stronger in 1990.
So with Bob Geldof and Bono and more on one side of Tony Blair and George Bush on the other, pulling in opposite directions, can Tony Blair come out of this summit with what he needs to say mission accomplished, to use a phrase?
Well, I don't think he'll use that phrase, but he will be. The Brits are very pleased. They did not think when Tony Blair talked about doubling aid to Africa from 25 to 50 billion that they would get really this close. And there may be a little bit of the fudging of the numbers, but they're going to say that they've got the extra 25 billion. In fact, there's discussion now about extra money for other parts of the world, other developing countries, and that's where there have been some last-minute discussions. But by and large, Blair is very happy. He's got something that matters to him morally, it matters to him politically for his base in the Labour Party in Britain, and it looks like he's got something the President Bush said didn't really happen in his relationship with Tony Blair, and that's a quid pro quo.
And on the climate change front, there's been a lot of talk about capping emissions. President Bush wants none of that. He's talking about new technologies, alternatives to fossil fuels. How's that being received?
Well, it's a point that they all can agree on. In fact, this is something that President Bush agreed on with Gerhard Schroeder in Germany earlier this year. Of course, in Germany, the Greens are much more strong politically, and it's seen as being a sort of an olive branch, as it were, something that everyone can come together on. Frankly, for environmentalists, it's nowhere near enough. There's nothing compulsory about it. It's very long-term, and it doesn't deal with the problem now.
And Richard, what about the position of the U.S. with its other big economic powers there? Is it the odd man out this year? There's been certainly a lot of dissent, a lot of strain in many of these relationships. Do you anticipate a coolness towards George Bush, toward the U.S. presence?
Well, recent research by the Pew Center has actually found that some of the public opposition in these countries to America has actually come down a little bit from the height of the Iraq War. So things aren't as bad as they used to be. Having said that, George Bush still has a huge image problem in many of these countries. Even countries like China are seen more favorably around the world in terms of foreign policy than the United States. Yes, there's coolness, there's awkwardness, but I would say it's improving, actually. And the president has put a lot of effort in with European allies this year to make the diplomacy start to get on a better track.
And finally, Richard, I hear that crowded bus you're on, Tony Blair will be there with Jacques Chirac. London has just won the 2012 Olympics over Paris. Much woe in Paris about that. Do you expect any public conversation about that at the G8?
Well, a lot of the conversation at the G8 is private, but I would find it hard to believe that Tony Blair could resist saying something to Jacques Chirac. Of course, Chirac made these very disparaging comments about British food, which are completely unintelligible to someone like me, but he was very disparaging generally. More seriously, there has been a really very personal and rancorous dispute between the two men over the future of Europe and the European budget. Of course, this is a nice moment for Blair to be magnanimous, and President Chirac has offered his congratulations, but it was a surprise that London won, and both leaders put a lot of their political capital in terms of making the pitch directly to the International Olympic Committee. So you've got to think that Blair is feeling good today.
Some special pleasure behind that public magnanimity. Richard Wolff, thanks so much. We hear you on your way in. Good luck, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Anytime.
Richard Wolff is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from the press bus on the way to the G8 summit in Scotland. So the G8 focuses on global warming this week, and as we just heard, even President Bush acknowledged yesterday that human activity has contributed to climate change. But critics still charge that White House refusal to engage global warming more aggressively represents a failure in U.S. leadership on a critical international issue. Those critics may need to look beyond Washington to places like Laredo, Texas, Charleston, South Carolina, and Portland, Oregon. Mayors of over 150 cities across the country just last month signed an agreement pledging to go green, to embrace the Kyoto goals and push initiatives that curb local greenhouse gas emissions. And they are beginning to get results. Portland recently announced it has hit the Kyoto mark, cutting its local emissions below 1990 levels. It's a hometown take on a huge global problem. In this hour, we'll hear how they do it. Tonight on Point, American town halls tackling global warming. You can join the conversation. Is your city, your town going green? Is local leadership the way forward in solving this worldwide problem? Or does the world still need Washington to take the lead in taking on climate change? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A little later in the program, we'll take a closer look at President Bush's vision on how to stop global warming. But first, the remarkable story of Portland, Oregon. We're joined now by Eric Sten, Portland's commissioner and city commissioner and director of the city's programs on energy policy and global warming. Eric Sten, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. What a great show.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. We're eager to learn about what you've done and how you've done it. And I guess the thing that hits us right across the face first is that while the rest of the world and the G8 are talking about it, somehow Portland is meeting that impossible Kyoto goal that the president said would wreck the U.S. economy. We understand a country is different from a community or a city, but you've done it. And how?
Well, I'm not so sure we're all that different. I think we didn't know we could get there, and we still have a ways to go. We have a 13% reduction in per capita emissions, and we've just got below the overall emissions. Keep in mind, our town was booming since 1990. We've had huge population influx into the region, and you know, what we found is that all of the basic things that we've been working on over the last 10 years that are really designed to make our city attractive, livable, you know, you hear all of the almost cliches now about you've got to attract people to your city, you want the creative class, all those types of things are tied to quality of life. And the simple message that we found is that the things that make your city more livable, therefore more attractive, therefore I'd even say more economically strong, actually turn out to reduce emissions. Smart land use planning, better energy strategy, alternate ways to get around town, old things like streetcars, new things like energy efficient light bulbs in our traffic lights, for example. They're all things that make the city better, and we actually were doing them for a variety of reasons, and it turned out they bring down emissions. And so in some ways, I think that you have two things going on at the national level. One is a predetermined point of view that's pushed by obvious economic interests that it's too expensive, and big surprise, the results come out that way. And secondly, a focus on the issue without kind of the context of how does it relate to all the other policies we're doing. It's not a standalone question. It's tied to what kind of cars we drive and all the other policies that the government is pushing.
But you've done it, and we'll look at how you've brought your CO2 emissions down to below 1990 levels in Portland and the surrounding county, and that's pretty incredible. That's the thing that the countries around the world are wrestling with, saying it cannot be done.
Well, we were the first U.S. city to adopt a local plan. We did it in 1993, and so we've been at it for some time. In the mid-90s, people would ask me, I've been on the council since 96, how did you get your citizens interested in global warming? I had the great pleasure to give a speech over in Japan. It's the first time I'd done anything like that back in 97. And somebody raised their hand, and they translated it and said, you know, why do your citizens care about global warming? And I was a little bit shocked and ended up saying, this is 97. And I think things have changed since then. But at that time, I said, they don't. They care about having ways to get downtown other than a car, a bus, bike lanes. They care a lot about recycling. It's something that they've paid a lot of attention to. Land use is a huge issue in Oregon. We have an urban growth boundary around our city so that we try and push more development into the central cities because it's more efficient and makes a more vibrant place. They care a lot about the air quality. They care a lot about the water quality.
And one piece at a time, it's added up to quite an incredible accomplishment. We're going to look at that in more detail after the break. Look how it fits into the big national and global picture. Eric Sten, we're thrilled to have you with us tonight. Stand by for just a moment. We're talking about local governments taking the lead in America in response to global warming. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As the G8 meets in Scotland, we are talking tonight about local governments taking the lead in America in response to global warming. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you looking up to the G8 to solve global warming or down the street to your town hall? And can communities act locally to solve this global problem? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you see? Do you see local green development as an economic drain or an economic boom? We'll hear a number of voices tonight. I'm joined right now from Portland, Oregon, a real leader at the local level in the country in exactly this effort, by Eric Sten. He's a Portland City Commissioner, Director of the City's Programs on Energy Policy, Global Warming, and Sustainable Development, a position in itself that I'm not sure many cities have, Eric.
Well, we have an interesting form of government. There's five of us elected citywide, one mayor and four commissioners, they call us.
Mm-hmm.
And same as the city council, except that each of the four of us is assigned bureaus or departments by the mayor. And so one of mine is the group that works on these issues.
Okay, I'm looking here at a laundry list of things that you've done, but I wish you'd take it through us. In 1993, you set out on this path, and what have been the steps that have allowed Portland, in spite of a lot of growth, to bring your CO2 emissions down below 1990 levels?
Well, there's four or five categories that all add up. One is land use, and it's critical if you're going to reduce emissions to better planned cities. You know, so many places you have to drive. One of my colleagues used to say, you know, use a gallon of gas to get a gallon of milk. We've done a lot of planning to try and shorten those kind of trips and make it easier to walk.
And this is Portland famously encouraging tighter development in the city center, not so much sprawl.
Yeah, exactly right. And the line we designed around the city region was very big. It wasn't like we, you know, took away a lot of planned development. We drew it back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And so part of this, the lesson of this is you have to start sometime, which I think is a hugely missing international policy. At some point, you have to start doing things. We've invested in light rails, which are basically, a bus on rails. Streetcars, we have a local streetcar system that kind of goes back to the early days before the automotive industry ripped them all out. We've put in 750 miles of bike lanes over the last few years. And again, what I'm getting at is point two, which is transportation. One of the largest ways that individuals emit greenhouse gases are through cars. And so if you can help people find ways to drive less, that helps a lot. And people like it. People like to get out of their cars. It's not like you're asking them to sacrifice if it's safe to walk. Downtown, you can ride the bus for free. So if you're going from one end of downtown to the other for a meeting, you don't need to get in your car. You jump on the bus for free, those kind of things. Our recycling system, this has been really copied a lot since then, but we were the first place to have curbside pickup of recycling. That was a big jump. And then we've a huge thing that got us over the top over the Kyoto standards in the last couple of years is that we've required that all buildings that the city invest in meet green standards.
And how does that contribute to cutting CO2 emissions? Buildings? We don't think of them as belching fumes.
It's the energy usage of the buildings primarily and the waste products of the buildings. And it's also the construction materials that you're using. I want to also be clear that we're using international protocols that were worked through and constantly updated by a group called the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives, which is a nonprofit that actually works with cities across the world. And what we found is that in every part of the world, mayors will go further than their presidents, whatever that ratio might be.
Very interesting. And that's putting pressure. I mean, I'm looking here at the list of cities that have signed on to this now, and it's really all over the map, red state and blue. We've got Little Rock and Los Angeles and Denver and Bridgeport, Connecticut, Miami, Tallahassee, Atlanta, right on down, Duluth, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Boston's on here, Madison, La Crosse, Wisconsin, Salt Lake City, lots of cities behind you but have signed on. But let me ask you about a couple of things here. We don't have many cities that have had your degree of success yet. They're in Portland or in the surrounding, is it pronounced Multnomah County?
Uh-huh, exactly right.
How much difference does it make if you clean up your CO2 emissions in that little spot on the great American map, on the great global surface? Is that a big deal, or is that just a kind of a mote in the eye of the problem?
Well, again, we are doing the things we're doing, and this is critical, not to tilt at windmills. Every step that we've taken is something that is really good for our city and has helped our economic climate, regardless of the fact that it lowers emissions, and that's critical. We haven't done hardly a single thing strictly for emissions. We've done them for multiple reasons. The point that we found is that smarter, thoughtful cities emit less. And that's the key. That being said, on the global picture, and we're becoming more aware of it with, you know, conversations like this, I actually believe that cities in America are potentially one of the keys to solving the problem if we're ever going to do it as a race of humans. And what I mean by that is, if you just do the math, Tom, you cannot take on global warming without the U.S. doing its part.
Clearly not. We're the biggest contributor to CO2 emissions.
I mean, not only are we a cultural leader, a business leader, we are mathematically too much of the problem. And so if you accept that premise, then in order to solve the problem worldwide, the U.S. has to move. If you look at both of the last two administrations, there's no evidence that D.C. is going to move. So therefore, the only way we are going to solve the national problem is through these local efforts changing the political paradigm.
Let me ask you something else then locally. We don't think of Portland, Oregon as a place with a lot of big industrial smokestacks. I mean, I have to admit, I'm not sure what your economy is, but what comes to mind is, I don't know, make potpourri and electronic circuits or something. Not big smokestack industries to the extent that we have those. So is it easier for Portland because of the kind of economy you have? Or are your restrictions and guidelines keeping out dirtier industry that's just going to go elsewhere?
I don't think so. I actually think it's harder in Portland because it's actually not so hard to clean up smokestacks. You know, a lot of that technology is available right now. But again, there's a lot of kind of subtle shading of the issue that comes from the national approach to this. And I think you just hit one of those maybe inadvertently, which is, keep in mind, Kyoto is you do better than you were doing before.
Mm-hmm.
So our improvement is relative to our economy, period. Same would be true for Pittsburgh or anywhere else. And frankly, I think most economies say that, you know, cities themselves, and this is an urban experience we're dealing with,
yes,
generally are looking at the same industries 10, 20 years from now. You know, the country is changing. But again, if you have the dirtier industries, you wouldn't be expected to get down to Portland's levels, which will inevitably be lower. You would be expected to get your levels down. And so I think the relative difficulty would be equal, perhaps even easier, for the simple reason that some of those industries can clean up much more efficiently than I think we're thinking.
They can, but of course, if you look at the national level again, it was just a week or so ago that we saw the U.S. Appeals Court siding with the administration, the Bush administration, upholding revisions to the Clean Air Act that allow plant operators to modernize without installing that new pollution control equipment. So that's not happening nationally. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, if I may, Eric. Abby Young is joining us from Berkeley, California. She's Director of Strategic Planning at the U.S. Office of the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives. Abby Young, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We're hearing Portland. We're hearing Portland's story. Tell us how big a wave is Portland part of here?
Yeah, Portland was one of the charter members of ICLEI, which is, as you said, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. And way back in the early 90s, we started a project called the pilot project was called the Urban CO2 for Carbon Dioxide Reduction Project. And we began with just a handful of cities, a couple from the U.S., Portland was one of them, some from Canada and some from Europe. And we threw the question out to them. We said, remember, way back in the early 90s, we said, if you were forced to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 20% below 1990 levels, what would you do? How would you go about doing it? And those local governments, over a period of 2 years, developed a methodology that we're using today all around the world, with over 600 communities around the world and over 150 here in the United States, to measure and plan and adopt targets and reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, first, at the local level, if I go into one of these cities, and let's put Portland aside for a moment because it's so far in the lead, it seems. Am I going to know that I'm in a city with different policies? Is it going to seem just like any other city? Are these 150 cities visibly different in the quality of the environment?
Well, you know, cities, one thing I've learned in doing this for the past 10 years, every city is different. You can't compare. And if you were to walk into a city, you know, if you were to look at things like, do they have active and widespread curbside recycling? That's something that you would be able to see. Do they have LED, which are very efficient traffic signals? That's something you'd be able to see.
This, instead of old-fashioned bulbs, save 80% on energy, save $500,000 a year, we read in Portland, with LED stoplights instead of the old-fashioned kind.
Exactly. So there are some things that you can see visibly. Do you have a vibrant downtown city core where people are, you know, not circling blocks trying to find parking, but they're using shuttle buses and they're biking and there are a lot of bike facilities. There are pedestrian avenues and malls and walkways. These are things that you can see. And they're not just things that, sure, they reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but what else do they do? They make our communities more livable. They make our communities more vibrant and more economically friendly to, you know, businesses want to come into these kinds of communities.
And so what other cities do you see as being particularly effective, aggressive, forward-leaning on this front?
There are many. It's really astonishing when you see the example of Portland, which is so thrilling and so exciting that they're showing these numbers, and then you look at how many other local governments are on the cusp of making this kind of achievement. We're looking at the Twin Cities in Minnesota, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the city of Seattle, the city of San Diego, the city of, out in your neck of the woods, and, you know, Cambridge is doing incredible things. All over the country, we're seeing some very, very impressive work with cities getting on the verge of achieving these kinds of reductions.
Eric Sten, what about the economics here? I see your mayor quoted saying people have looked at this the wrong way as a drain. In fact, it's economical. It makes sense in dollars. But how do the dollars sort out? I mean, our impression is that we're sort of told that industry wants to go where it's cheaper to operate. That means fewer restrictions on how it operates.
Our economy may be a little different, but I don't think so. We tend to subscribe to more of the argument that business right now in this country is really hungry for educated workers who can add value. And that workforce is harder and harder to find if you listen to all of the trends, and is much more searching for a place they want to be. And so where I'm going with this is that I grew up in Portland, spent my whole life in Portland except for going to school, and I love it here. But we are trying to be a place that attracts individuals, and we believe business flows from that, not the other way around. And, you know, we're not seeing any businesses leave because we're trying to be a better place to live. In fact, what we hear from businesses is that I'm considering moving there because the type of employees I want live there. Will that make us the most competitive place in the country for every single industry? No. Does it have us on most everybody's list of the hottest places to consider moving your business? Yes, I'll take it.
And Abby, when we talk about local solutions, I guess it's not all at the community level. Some of this is going on at the state level. Arnold Schwarzenegger has been quite vigorous recently. He said, talking about global warming, the debate is over. We know the time for action is now. He's proposing cutting California's greenhouse gas emissions by 25%. Now, California's got a bigger economy, probably more emissions than many European countries. That's a very big deal, I assume.
It is a big deal, and I happen to be wearing two hats, I guess. I also serve on the California's Climate Change Advisory Committee, and we have a hearing coming up next week, so your question's timely. Yes, this is something that states across the country are finally starting to look at and take very, very seriously. Many states have adopted targets for reduction, and we're also seeing states working in partnership with other states. This was started back in the Northeast, again in your neck of the woods, with the New England governors and the Eastern Canadian premiers adopting an agreement on climate protection about 4 years ago. Built into that were very aggressive and serious targets for reducing emissions that the region, both the Eastern Canada and New England states, were going to try to achieve together, and then each of those provinces and states in turn were adopting similar targets to support that regional initiative. We're seeing this. California and Governor Schwarzenegger's statement is part of the Western Governor's Agreement on Climate Change, the governors of California, Oregon, and Washington. And so we're hoping that this will also become a multi-state regional effort here on the West Coast.
I want to talk more about this, how this filters up to the national and the global level, but I want to begin to let our callers in, if I may. David is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I very much appreciate your subject tonight, in part because I've spent the last 10 days in Asia. And I look at this as that is local being the only long-term solution.
Why do you say that, David? Why?
Because if you look at what our national governments are doing, they are protecting they're protecting business. They are want to ensure the continual expansion of their economies, and that is their consideration before the Kyoto Accords.
But don't local economies want to be well sustained and growing as well? I mean,
and your mayor from Portland hit that spot on, and that is every single change that helped the environment was also proven to be economically viable and in the interest of his people first. And the added benefit was that it was an advantage to the environment.
But do you think it will add up to a global solution, David? Can local communities ultimately pull off the thing that stops the warming that's much bigger than any town or state?
I absolutely believe that. That is the only way that this will move forward, because conversely, national policy takes a while to, and sometimes never, trickles down to the local economy. And the example I will use for that is this. In the Asian Times, just 2 days ago, I read where China has signed on to the Kyoto Accords for whatever their reasons were. But last month, they closed down 35 electric plants in districts around their country.
Mm-hmm.
These were coal-fired plants that were contributing massive amounts of pollution into the area. And they fell so far short of the Kyoto Accords that the national government agreed to that the national government was forced to close them down. However, China is in the middle of an expansion unseen in our history.
Right.
And their response to that is the national response, was to shut them down because they politically, agreeing with the Kyoto Accords, had no other choice.
Of course, they've got a huge pollution problem brewing there, and what you're describing is a national effort, but with impact at the local level. David, thank you for your call. Erickson, what about it? Do you think this adds up to national policy? Is it a substitute for national policy?
I think you need both, and I think national policy should be a lot further along. I actually believe, and this is a lot bigger topic, and my belief, I probably can't prove with all the big economists, is that the U.S. is risking our economy by being this slow to move.
Because?
Well, I've worked with the cities around the world. I've had a chance to talk to a lot of mayors and colleagues around the world, and what you see is that as China and other places start to move, they're going to develop products and markets and other approaches that if we are so out of step with their approach, how are our businesses going to compete? At some point, and it's not yet, I think this administration being this slow puts our businesses at risk because there are international norms that are developing. And, at some point, you can't be so strong that you're an island. The other piece on the local, in terms of your question, Tom, is that I do think a piece of taking on global warming that's missed in all the national discussion is behavior change, and not some sort of Jimmy Carter put on a sweater, but give people better choices so that they can reach their quality of life that they want without polluting as much.
And they can enjoy it right there on their block. Eric Sten in Portland, Abby Young in Berkeley, California tonight. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about local governments taking the lead in America in response to global warming. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in Portland's story, in local stories from around the country? If enough local communities step up green, could it, in effect, transform national policy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As the G8 meets in Scotland, we're talking tonight about local governments taking the lead in America in response to global warming. We've been joined tonight by Eric Sten. He's a Portland City Commissioner, Director of the City's Programs on Energy Policy, Global Warming, and Sustainable Development. Abby Young is with us as well. She's Director of Strategic Planning at the U.S. Office of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. A lot of activity around this poll. 150-some mayors in the country have signed their towns up to try to push toward the global protocol that President Bush has rejected. You can join the conversation tonight. Is your community going green or trying to? What's working and what's not? Is local action a substitute for global G8 scale agreements? Is it just a finger in the dike or something more? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to expand our circle a little bit right now. We're joined by Mark Levy. Joins us tonight from New City, New York. He's Associate Director of Columbia University's Center for Earth Science Information Network, one of the authors of the 2005 Environmental Sustainability Index. Mark Levy, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So give us your take on this. We're hearing about Portland's quite remarkable success in hitting that Kyoto mark of taking their CO2 emissions back below 1990 levels. A lot of other towns signing up. Of course, they haven't all made that kind of progress at this point. But how big a deal is this? Is this local communities just being nicer to live in? Or does it add up to, collectively, a policy that rolls back global warming?
Well, I think it's really neither of those extremes. It's clearly a gigantic step forward. It really helps introduce a new element of competition among local governments and local citizens. It sets very clear targets on the part of these mayors that their citizens can then hold them accountable to. And it forces people, it really makes the climate change issue real for people in their day-to-day lives in ways that was harder to do before. So it helps spark a much deeper debate about how big a problem this is for people and what resources they're willing to commit to help solve it.
Does it fix the problem?
It's clearly not enough to fix the problem, and I wouldn't think that any of your other guests would argue that, or any of the mayors would presume that that's true. It's a necessary step, but it's far from sufficient. One of the problems I have with the local targets that have been set is that many of them copy the Kyoto Agreement in form. They set a relatively achievable reduction of greenhouse gas emissions as their target. And in a sense, that's probably the best that they can do, because that's the kind of policy goal that they have policy levers to help achieve.
You say relatively achievable, but President Bush said aiming for Kyoto would wreck the U.S. economy.
Well, I think there's very little evidence to support President Bush's claim that an ambitious greenhouse gas reduction target would wreck the U.S. economy. Other countries have set ambitious goals and have shown no economic hardship as a result of that. I think rather the onus is on the opposite argument that doing nothing to prevent climate change is something that we can tolerate.
But I'm sorry, I interrupted you there. I guess you were going to whether or not that goal is sufficient.
Right. And I think that when you look at the the ultimate debate that we need to have as a global society is not what level of reductions in emissions are we going to deem mandatory, but really what kind of climate do we want to have for our future? How much of the concentrations of greenhouse gases are we willing to tolerate in the air? And that's a goal that we can only really be set by a large consensus of global society. And what most of the scientists seem to be arguing is that, you know, we can only tolerate a concentration on the order of 400 to 500 parts per million of CO2. And we're headed for a trajectory of roughly double that. And the mayors, you know, for all their goodwill and good intentions, are not going to be able to enforce a path towards a stable climate in the future. That's really going to take national leadership coordinated among the big economies of the world.
Abby Young, do you buy that? You represent an awful lot of local communities. Is there a ceiling to what they can accomplish?
Well, first I'd like to clarify that most of the local governments that are participants in the Cities for Climate Protection program, which is what this program is called today, that have adopted targets far more aggressive than the Kyoto target.
Really?
Which is a 7% reduction below 1990 levels.
Okay.
Most of the local governments that have adopted reduction targets are seeking targets more along the lines of what the city of Portland has done to reduce emissions 20% below 1990 levels. And of course, this is always has to be put into the context of this is the necessary first step.
But we've got that, but does it add up to a solution, or is it always going to be insufficient? Do we have to have G8 and Washington-level solutions here?
Absolutely. You have to have federal and international solutions. In fact, the city of Portland, it's all that much more impressive, the achievement that the city of Portland has made, because it has made that in spite of federal inertia on things like CAFE standards.
That's emissions, automobile emissions. I want to get to our callers. Jim is on the line. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Jim Marzilli. I'm a member of the Massachusetts House of Representatives.
Oh, good to have you, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
I think that the question you asked earlier about whether the cities can supplant the federal government starts to get us to the answer. I think that the real key here is that we need to have local, state, and federal policies. Each level of government has a particular capacity, a particular strength, mm-hmm. in its ability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. From the last few years of negotiations around the Kyoto Treaty, where Abby and I have been going for a while, we see that the rest of the world, especially Europe, is looking towards state and local government to take the lead that the feds have refused to. So, for example, in New England and the northeastern states, we've got a year-and-a-half-long process now called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, where we're trying to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the utility sector by creating a model rule across the region that will allow us to cap carbon dioxide emissions from the utility sector, produce permits for the utilities, and allow those to be traded, really integrated into the international market, including the European Union's emissions trading system. That's something that municipal government can't do, and that's really something that's difficult for the feds to do under these circumstances. But with the CCP program, the Cities for Climate Protection program, pushing on land use policy and on green buildings and on just general energy use, and with state actions, including in states that have Republican governors.
And that's happening, you're saying?
That's absolutely. The REGI process was initiated by Republican Governor Pataki in New York. Most of the New England and the northeastern states have Republican governors.
Jim, do you think it's going to add up to a change in national policy, or does it just kind of supplant national policy from beneath somehow?
Well, I think it supplants it a little bit from beneath, but it does not. It's not sufficient on its own. More worrisome is the fact that so much that's going on now at the national level is aimed at preempting and prohibiting states and local government from acting on this issue. So, for example, right now, the Congress is contemplating enacting legislation that would prohibit states from enacting energy efficiency standards for major appliances.
Wow, that's right, on refrigerators and washing machines and so on.
Exactly.
I read about that. Why would they want to do that?
It is essentially industry by industry carving out laws that they think benefit them, and with this Congress, in particular the Republicans in Washington, who are more than willing to do that. So last year, for example, we saw Home Depot essentially get an exemption so that no state can regulate ceiling fence.
Ceiling fence. I saw that. Jim, we're almost out of time, but we appreciate your call and your thoughts there. Massachusetts State Representative calling in. Eric Stan in Portland, do you feel pinched by federal restrictions on what you can do at the state or local level?
Less restricted at this point and more that we'd like their help. There are some things, but they don't hit us too hard. It's more that they're neither investing in the right things, and if you look at the highway bills and all the places that our money goes, and although the federal government has been a big part of our light rail, and I don't want to miss that point, but they could do more in those fronts, and also that they're not being proactive. I mean, to me, it's just self-evident. You need a local, state, and national plan. What I think, however, though, is perhaps our local plans, if people were willing to look at them with an open mind, have put some new perspective in place, that maybe some of the assumptions that nobody will change their behavior, that industry can't survive, are wrong. Not so much that they supplant the national, but hopefully, and I'm being optimistic here in this point, maybe not with this president, but that it will give people a way to reframe the debate. People of goodwill can look at our experience and say, maybe a couple of the assumptions that went into this national strategy are wrong.
Mark Levy, do you see that happening? You did the Environmental Sustainability Index. U.S. ranked 45, number 45 in the world on environmental sustainability. Do you see the example of local and state efforts persuading national officials and political leaders that change is possible?
Well, I think that the one thing that these local initiatives are helping to do is to separate the kind of ideological opposition to effective climate change policy from the national debate. So at the most extreme in the last 10 years, it was really almost impossible to have an effective debate within Congress because the opposition was just unwilling to even talk about the issue. And what the mayor's initiative has done is shown that you can actually, think about the issue, debate it publicly, get support for action, and start taking steps. And, everything won't collapse as a result. And I think there's already signs that that's making a difference at the national level. But the one thing that this effort can't do is solve the global problem. I think that this is really not an economic issue, but more of a moral issue. And the people who will suffer if we don't solve the climate change problem are much less the future U.S. presidents and much more the world's poorest. And I think solving the climate change problem is something that we need to do in order to prevent their suffering. And that's something that really is a national responsibility. And so if these local initiatives can help not only implement progress locally, but help put pressure at the national level to take responsibility for dealing with this problem globally, then it'll do everything it needs to do.
We've got the picture, and it's a fascinating one. Mark Levy at the Columbia University Center for Earth Science Information Network, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
And Abby Young with the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, thank you for joining us, Abby, tonight.
Thank you.
And Eric Sten in Portland, Oregon, national leader locally in this, a Portland City Commissioner. Eric, thanks a lot for telling us your story.
Oh, thanks for doing it.
Wonderful to have you. In a moment, a look at two competing visions for solving global warming. This is On Point. So, global warming is on the table at the G8 summit, and the Kyoto Protocol still stands as the international community's preferred strategy to fight climate change. All members of the G8 except the United States, the world's largest polluter, have signed it. President Bush has a different vision, saying that new technologies, not emissions caps, are the best way to curb global warming. Two different answers to a very big problem. For a closer look at how the Bush plan differs from Kyoto and what works and what doesn't work in each, we turn to David Victor, professor of political science and director of the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. He joins us tonight from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. David Victor, thanks very much for being with us.
Good evening.
So we've seen President Bush just in the last couple of days saying he hopes we are now in the post-Kyoto world, where solutions are focused on alternatives to fossil fuels and new technologies, as opposed to rolling back emissions through emissions restraints. Are these polar opposites? What do you see in these two attitudes, views, paths toward addressing climate change?
Well, to some degree, they're opposites in strategy. They are two different ways to think about the apologies for the ringing in the background.
It happens all over the world.
There are two different ways to think about addressing the problem. I think at the core here, the European countries are much more concerned about the climate change problem under much stronger public pressure to do something about it. And so not surprisingly, they've gone ahead and put pretty significant limits on their emissions of greenhouse gases.
But is technological advance a real alternative to those controls?
Oh, technological advance is essential, and technological advance is also essential to the European strategy, because the only way we're going to really stop climate change is by cutting emissions of greenhouse gases by 60 or 80%. And that means completely reorganizing the energy system, probably away from fossil fuels. And if we use fossil fuels, to use them in a way where we capture the carbon dioxide and inject it underground or sequester it away in some place. So both visions require technological change. To some degree, there are differences in strategy about how to get there.
Will President Bush's work, and do you see the world sort of shifting horses here from Kyoto to the promise of technology change, or are you saying you've got to have both?
Well, you have to have both. I think President Bush has a severe weakness with his plan, which is that he's relying entirely on technological change, and he's not providing a strong and credible signal to industry to go out and invent on their own the new technologies and to put them into place. If you're running a power plant and you don't think there's going to be any kind of binding limit on your greenhouse gas emissions, you don't have a very strong incentive to go out and find a different way to generate electricity. And that is the heart of the weakness with the president's plan.
So politically, in policy terms, do you expect the United States to stay alone in this, or Europe to sign on, you know, technology plus, and can the global problem be solved if the U.S. doesn't adopt the plus, the emissions controls?
Well, in the near term, what's likely to happen, for example, this week in Glen Eagles, is that some crafty scheme will be put together where everybody agrees to sit under a big tent, and the Europeans have their approach, and the Americans have their approach, and we all think that they work to a common end. In the long haul, it's completely impossible to really tackle this problem without also imposing significant limits on greenhouse gases. And that means the United States. We're the world's largest economy. We're responsible for a quarter of the emissions. There's no way that this problem is going to be solved without the U.S. also doing its part.
There's been a lot of talk about business coming around on that very front, General Electric and others, but will it ultimately happen without a mandate from Washington?
Well, the shift in business reflects in large part smart business strategy. For example, General Electric is a major player in the windmill business, and there are subsidies or implicit subsidies for building wind power plants, and they want to sell more of that. They sell jet engines, which are more efficient than the last generation of jet engines. They like to sell more jet engines. BP has just announced last week a major new power plant that they're building with some partners that will generate electricity and not emit any greenhouse gases. They're doing that because there are binding limits on greenhouse gas emissions.
But not everybody has those same business interests. David Victor, you've given us a great window into this tonight. We're grateful to you for being with us.
Thank you.
Stanford University's David Victor, he joined us from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.